from the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. The mass shooting last evening at the popular Gilroy Garlic Festival left three festival-goers dead. The shooter was killed by police. About 15 others were injured. We're expecting a news conference this hour to provide additional details. We'll also talk politics later this hour, including a new USCLA Times poll showing the challenge for lower-tier candidates. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, we'll be focused on the latest political news, new USC Los Angeles Times poll showing what a challenge it is for all but the top four candidates in the Democratic presidential race to try and break through. They'll have opportunities tomorrow night and Wednesday night with nationally televised debates. But with such a large field, trying to get enough airtime or a concept that breaks through, this is extremely difficult. As Hetty just told you, there is a news conference in Gilroy that's scheduled this hour to bring the very latest details about the investigation into yesterday's mass shooting, which occurred in the final hour of the very popular garlic festival that Gilroy does each year. It's a fundraiser for different nonprofits in town, and around 100,000 people visit each three-day weekend a year that the city does this event. With us is the acting Silicon Valley Bureau Chief for KQED News, Rachel Miro, former colleague of mine here at KPCC. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. It's lovely to talk with you again, even under awful circumstances.
It's terrible circumstances. We have three festival goers who were dead. The shooter was killed by police. And then we have, what, around 15 people that were taken to hospitals?
Yes, 15 has now been confirmed. We have a press conference that is running as we speak.
We just got a little connection problem there with Rachel. We'll try and get her back. Needless to say, the demand is high on the cell network there in Gilroy. We'll try and get Rachel back. Rachel, you there? Nope, she cut out. Okay. We'll try and get her back on, and we'll try and get you the details of that news conference, which is scheduled to be getting underway. Rachel, you back there with us?
Yes. We're hopefully going to be hearing some confirmation, various facts and figures which have...
All right, we take you now to the news conference live in Gilroy.
Thank you all for being here this morning. You know, one of my greatest honors in life was being elected mayor of this great community. And I can tell you that the people of Gilroy are strong. We're resilient, and during the course investigation, as law enforcement continues to research and investigate it, the Gilroy community will mourn, but we will get through it. On behalf of the community and the Gilroy City Council, I'm speaking to you today to provide a brief update on where we're at. Later on the agenda, you'll get additional information from our public safety personnel. As you know, yesterday afternoon, the city of Gilroy endured a tragedy that a very long night cannot erase. Mass gun violence is an epidemic in the United States, and yet one never imagined such a thing can happen here in our beautiful community. It's beyond sad to see wonderful and charitable event like the Gilroy Garlic Festival that donates tens of thousands of dollars each year to local nonprofits. To have an event like this happen. as I said before, we are resilient and we will get through this. This morning, our prayers are with the families of those injured and killed in the senseless shooting. We stand with you and we will be providing whatever assistance we can in the days and weeks ahead. This morning, as we learn more about what occurred yesterday, I wish to commend the bravery of our law enforcement personnel who, in the middle of a chaotic situation, acted quickly and professionally to engage the shooter and to end the threat before more people could be injured or killed. And the chief will talk a little bit more about that. It takes remarkable bravery to run to a shooting when the natural reaction for all of us is to run away. We are so proud of our law enforcement, who undoubtedly saved many lives by putting their own lives in danger. Now, I also want to mention our fantastic fire department. I happened to be in the triage area when the victims started to come in, and I could tell you that our fire personnel, paramedics, EMTs were there quickly triaging, prioritizing, stabilizing each of the patients, and then getting them ready to transport out. Today and over the next few days, I, along with the Gilroy City Council, will be meeting and working with community leaders to assess the situation we now face in Gilroy in the wake of this shooting. We intend to come out of this horrible event in a stronger and obviously a closer community. Again, thank you for being here. Let me turn it back over.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mayor next Roland Velasco of Gilroy.
Jeff Klett.
Good morning, everybody. As the mayor said, first of all, I'd like to thank our firefighters for responding heroically to this event. This is something that we trained for. In fact, had an active shooter training with our colleagues in the police department about a year ago. And we're actually planning another one because of another unfortunate event just north of us in Morgan Hill, also involving an active shooter. Luckily that we were at an event, so we had 6 total fire department personnel on scene when this shooting occurred, 2 on an engine in the park, 2 on bike teams, and 2 that were in an ambulance inside the park. So we were able to respond quickly to the situation when the shooting occurred. We had 12 EMS public and private personnel also on scene, an EMT contract, and a public ambulance company there as well. The initial dispatch occurred at 1742 hours. We sent 4 engines, and for note, we only have 3 engines in the city of Gilroy, so we sent all of our resources as well as our South County neighbors. 2 additional battalion chiefs, and then requested 16 local mutual aid engines to respond down here as well. Our Gilroy battalion chief assumed command at 1745 hours, along with the first arriving fire engine that was dispatched from outside of the Garlic Festival event. We had a total of 6 ground ambulances and 2 supervisors from the county. We had 3 air ambulances, and we did a total of 16. There were 16 total transports, 13 of which were done by the fire department and the EMS agency. 3 of those, again, were air ambulances, and 8 ground ambulances. And I will leave it to the police department to talk about the actual state of the deceased in this event. Thank you.
Next to speak to you, Police Chief Scott Smithy.
You're listening to a live news conference from Gilroy.
So I'll reiterate what I said at the press conference last night, and I've got a few additional details. And then we'll also be planning an additional update, because I plan on having more information now that daylight's here and we're getting fresh resources in. So we'll try to put something together for you for later this afternoon. We've got the date and time established already, and as most of you know, the Gilroy Garlic Festival is an event that we put on every year. And we typically host between 80 and 100,000 people to our festival. It takes several thousand people a day volunteering to make this festival work. And so at the time that the incident occurred, you know, it was near the end of the final day. It was last night, Sunday. Questions that were asked, you know, regarding the security and the way that we manage and monitor it from a law enforcement and public safety perspective, is that we have police personnel on site the entire time of the festival. We actually create a police compound where we have a command center, a booking area, you know, all the things that you would need to run a major operation like this. The officers are deployed throughout the park, and they're assigned to different regions of the park, so they're spread out. We don't have officers all in one spot. When this call came in, the shots being fired, the closest team of officers responded immediately. They were there in engaging the suspect in less than a minute. The suspect was armed with an assault-type rifle, and he, as soon as he saw the officers, he engaged the officers and fired at the officers with that rifle. And I had three officers that engaged the suspect. And despite the fact that they were outgunned with their handguns against a rifle, those three officers were able to fatally wound that suspect. And the event ended very quickly. Of course, then we had the aftermath of dealing with the victims and the EMS side of things. We put out a call for help. We had over 20 agencies, federal, state, county, and local agencies from all over that responded people down into our park. And it was just incredible to see the cooperation and how quickly they put this together and how quickly they were able to render aid to people. I can't tell you how proud I am of the officers for being able to engage this guy as quickly as they did, because we had thousands of people there in a very small area, and you know, it could have gone so much worse so fast. And so I'm really proud that they got there as quickly as they did, and that they were successful in taking the threat out of the equation. We do have three people deceased, confirmed deceased. We have one who is a six-year-old male victim. We also had a 13-year-old female victim. And then we had another male victim in his 20s. We don't have a motive for the shooting as yet. We did have reports of a potential second suspect. We don't have any confirmation that any second suspect did any shooting, but we certainly are investigating all leads to try to determine who that potential second suspect is and what exactly that person's role was. We found out, some of the federal agencies helping us out. We found out that the rifle that this suspect used was an SKS. It was an AK-47 type assault rifle. It was purchased legally in the state of Nevada on July the 9th of this year. And reports have been going out of potential suspect. And I will confirm that the suspect is the person that several news media have been inquiring about, Santino William Logan, who is 19 years old. And I say that name with some hesitation because I don't believe that somebody like this deserves the notoriety, the recognition. But I also understand that you all, you know, want to have some confirmation of that. I think the last thing I'll say before I turn it over, I want to thank all of the agencies and all of the people that came to help. I don't even know how many people, but there was a lot. And we put out the call for help. They came. Because it's such a large crime scene, the FBI has come in and offered some assistance, and we've accepted that assistance because of the size of the area that we need to cover. And so before we open it up for questions, I'm going to have them come up and talk a little bit about their role and how they're helping us with this case, and then I'll come back up.
Sarah Gilroy, Chief of Police Scott Smithy. You're
next
listening to the live news conference.
Deputy Special Agent in Charge of the FBI, Craig Fair.
Thank you. My name is Craig Fair. I'm the Deputy Special Agent in Charge of the San Francisco Division of the FBI. First off, I'd like to express my condolences to the city of Gilroy and to the family, friends, and victims of this absolutely heinous act. The FBI's principal role is assisting the city and the Police Department of Gilroy in the investigation. Our preeminent and principal concern at this point is motivation, ideological leanings. Was he affiliated with anyone or any group? That still has to be ruled out, still has to be determined at this point. And we are supporting Gilroy Police Department in making those determinations. Our evidence recovery team, it's a sizable team. We have about 30 individuals out there right now collecting evidence. As we find evidence, as we flag it, as we mark it and map it, we're determining that the crime scene is much more expansive than what we originally thought, and it amounts to many, many, many acres. We appreciate the public's patience as we process this. It's done very slowly, it's done very methodically, and it's done for a reason should we have to use that evidence in prosecution later on. I'd also like to thank the first responders. As the mayor cited in their heroism, the FBI personnel who worked tirelessly throughout the evening and will do so for the next several days. Our partnership with the Gilroy Police Department and the city of Gilroy as we move through this crisis, and members of the general public who are offering, continue to send in tips, photos, and assist with the investigation. Thank you.
You're listening to live coverage, Gilroy, California News Conference on 89.3 KPCC.
I saw that hand go up first.
Thank you. Probably for the chief, but you talked about the potential of another suspect. Do you believe there's somebody else out there, or is there the potential that those were erroneous reports and that they thought they saw somebody who might not be there?
You know, we really don't know. We've gotten multiple reports that there may have been another person with him, that they ran this way or they ran that way, but different people give different versions, so we really don't know at this point.
I saw this hand go up next.
Would you be able to identify the victims at this point?
We are not identifying the victims at this point. Typically, that's something that we leave up to the county coroner's office to make sure that all their notifications are done before that's released.
The gentleman and Josh.
Two questions for you. Had your officers not acted quicker, would there have been more bloodshed? And were those officers worth body cameras?
So the answer to the first question is there absolutely would have been more bloodshed, I believe. With the number of people in the small area that they were in, I think it's very, very fortunate that they were able to engage him as quickly as they did. And then the second part of the question is, our officers do wear body cameras. Who was at the moment that this happened and who's had them on, or what? I don't have that information yet, but we will get that as we move forward in the investigation.
Gentleman with the mustache.
Chief, could you give us a rough idea, sort of a laundry list of the type of evidence you were trying to gather? Because I know you want to try to find out what the motivation was. What type of things are you and other law enforcement agencies trying to gather to help trying to figure out what triggered all this.
Well, there's a number of different aspects of an investigation like this, and we have partners from all different agencies. So, you know, whether it's information concerning the suspect, whether it's information concerning this potential second person, there's a very, very large crime scene that needs to be processed diligently. There's all kinds of background information that we need to process. It's going to be a very prolonged and complicated process for us.
Can you give us, though, as a follow-up, can you give us some idea of things you're looking at? I'm guessing maybe computers, the types of people you're talking to try to learn more about him?
Yeah, I am not comfortable at this point because I don't have enough of a detail of that level of briefing to comment on that. I may be able to do that later today.
The gentleman with the blue shirt under the TV set.
I am not ready to comment on that yet. I don't have that level of detail either.
Are you familiar with him? And we were told he was from Gilman. Did he have a record, anything along those lines? And also, is he the one who purchased the gun legally from the back?
As far as his local background, again, I'm not ready to comment on that. My understanding that he is the one that purchased the weapon in Nevada.
We had seen that he had moved to Nevada. Can you confirm if he was living in Nevada? Do you know what brought him there? And then how long had he been back in California before this incident happened?
I don't have that information yet. I think he was living with family members, but he's originally from Gilroy. I don't yet know how long he was in Nevada or how long he had been back.
One last question.
Many people had to rush away, obviously, from the campground. What are you telling people who are maybe wanting to return? And then second question is, since this is an ongoing investigation, how secure is the campgrounds and surrounding area?
Chief, would you like to address that?
Yeah, well, I would say that it's very secure. We have quite a large number of personnel out establishing a perimeter around the area because we have to do the evidence processing. There are people that were at the festival that literally ran away and left their belongings, and we have vehicles and there's vendor tents and whatnot. We can't allow them back in until we finish with the evidence processing portion of this. So we have a team that's set up to help assist those people to provide some support until we can get them back to their belongings.
Chief, can you talk about the victims? They were so young. We have three people under the age of 22, children. We talk a lot about the suspect here, but can you speak to it, all these young lives they've lost? And they've been talking about it.
Well, I think any time a life is lost, it's a tragedy. But when it's young people, it's even worse. And it's very difficult. I don't know what, if any, association there is. It seems that this was a random act, but again, we've got a long way to go before we can come to a determination what his motivation was.
You've been listening to a live news conference from Gilroy, California, the Santa Clara County community, just about 15 miles south of San Jose. That was the chief of police for Gilroy. That was Scott Smithy, visibly emotional as he was talking about the incident yesterday, which occurred in the final hour on the final day of the three-day Gilroy Garlic Festival. It's a big fundraiser for local charities. Draws about 100,000 people over the course of the weekend. It's one of the most popular food festivals anywhere in the western United States. And we heard him identify the gunman who was shot and killed soon after being engaged by Gilroy police officers. According to Chief Smithy, they engaged Santino William Logan and after pursuing him, shot him. He died from his injuries. The weapon that the shooter is believed to have used was an SKS rifle, the chief describing it as an AK-47 type of rifle that had legally been purchased July 9th of this year in Nevada. Brought, it would appear, illegally into California, where you're not allowed to bring weapons like that into the state because there is a ban on the sales of that type of gun here in California. So the purchase may have been legal in Nevada, but it would appear it was not legal to bring it across state lines. We have, as you just heard, three young people who were victims, a six-year-old boy, a 13-year-old girl, and a young man in his 20s. They have not been identified yet by the coroner's office of Santa Clara County. And we have an ongoing investigation, as we heard from the FBI, as to any motivation of the shooter, whether there was any ideological leaning that drove this crime, and also a check of social media to try and determine those things about the person who killed the three individuals and wounded 15 others at the Gilroy Garlic Festival yesterday afternoon. You'll be hearing continuing coverage throughout the course of the day from Hedy Lynn Hurdies, also from NPR News on All Things Considered this afternoon. Coming up, we'll talk politics. That's what we usually do on Monday. We have two political experts to join us, and we'll find out their thoughts about some of the latest developments, including on the USC Los Angeles Times candidates poll. We'll be back in 1 minute. Listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. If you were with us for our Saturday night film week screening at the Theater at Ace Hotel, wonderful night. We had a huge audience, nearly filling every seat. It was just great. Terrific post-screening conversation afterwards. And if you were there, thank you for coming and supporting KPCC and seeing a great film on the big screen like that. What a fun evening. Coming up later today on Air Talk, we'll take a look at San Luis Obispo's new policy on public art, which bans any monuments of people, no statues, because they consider it's just too controversial to put up a statue of anybody. We'll talk about the reasons behind that and whether we're going to see that as a growing trend. But first, in political news, President Trump got two pieces of good news. One of them, the U.S. Supreme Court not getting in the way of the Trump administration using Pentagon funds to construct portions of a U.S.-Mexico border wall. And the president announcing that he had negotiated, or his team had, with Guatemala, asylum application limits to the U.S. That those who pass through Guatemala would have to seek asylum there. With me, the dean of the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University, Pete Peterson, and UC Riverside Professor of Political Science, Jennifer Marola. Thank you both for being with us. Pete, let me start with you first of all. A couple of big legal wins for the president. He's not used to having many of those.
Yeah, that's true, Larry. Certainly on the border financing, that was a big win for the president. In some ways, it doesn't build any new border fencing or not much of it. At least the financing that was cleared is really designated towards supporting four existing contracts and the 100 miles of border fencing for the most part in New Mexico and Arizona is really replacing existing fence. So that certainly is an important win for the president. This other piece about Guatemala, it's always been a major point of the president that as people attempt to cross the border in the United States, they're crossing hundreds, if not over 1,000 miles to get to the U.S. And so seeking other support by Mexico and Central American countries in on these caravans or on the migrant groups that are coming across has always been a part of what they believe is the solution to this problem.
Jennifer Merola, good to have you with us. Welcome to our political analysis. Your thoughts on the president, those two border issues from Friday?
Yeah, thank you. I agree with Pete that it's pretty big news for Trump because he can at least partially fulfill one of his signature campaign promises that he made in 2016, though, of course, it is limited with what the funds can be used for, and also with respect to the deal that was struck with Guatemala. Thinking about how this may play, though, on the other side, while it's not welcome news on the left, it may be a way to galvanize support, right? So kind of this building of a wall, replacing fencing, it's no longer a remote possibility, so that may actually help mobilize Democrats. It will keep the issue certainly very salient during the primaries and probably leading into the general election. I think the left can take some advantage of these issues. On the one hand, they can talk about, right, kind of replacing the fencing, maybe wasting some money. It may not be particularly effective. And at the same time, right, they may think about spending resources in other areas like, you know, improving conditions in some of the detention centers. And at least on the issue of Guatemala, they may want to do something like play up that it's actually quite dangerous to have people stay in countries where they're trying to seek asylum to get out of dangerous conditions. I mean, that's at least been the concern among advocacy groups.
We'll continue our conversation with Professor Jennifer Merola of UC Riverside and Pete Peterson, Dean of the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University in Malibu. We'll talk about the stakes involved in tomorrow and Wednesday night's Democratic presidential candidates debate to be aired on CNN. The first round didn't really shake things up a whole heck of a lot. We now have also a new USC LA Times poll, which shows significant distance between the four leading candidates on the Democratic side and everybody else in that vast field. We'll talk about what they need to do to distinguish themselves to move out from the lower pack. We'll be back right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Good to have you with us on Air Talk on this Monday. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking politics with UC Riverside Professor of Political Science Jennifer Merola and Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine University School of Public Policy. He's also Senior Fellow at Pepperdine's Davenport Institute. And we have a new LA Times USC Dornsife poll, which has come out looking at the Democratic field of candidates and showing that Joe Biden continues with a substantial lead that is unchanged since back in April, the last time SC Dornsife LA Times put this out. Joe Biden with 28% of likely Democratic voter support. Behind him is Bernie Sanders at 11%, so less than half of Biden's support. And Sanders has also seen his support drop about 50% since April in this tracking poll. Kamala Harris has seen a slight bump up to 10%. Elizabeth Warren has seen a significant bump from 4% to 10%. So those are your top four. And with Sanders, Harris, and Warren, they're really within the margin of error, well behind Joe Biden. And then everybody else, Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke, the other candidates, way, way down, many of them with just 1% or less in the poll. Jennifer Merola, let me start with you. We've got the two debates coming up back to back tomorrow and Wednesday night. The stakes seem pretty high, doesn't it, for any of those Democrats below the top four?
Oh, yes, they certainly are, especially because after this series of debates, the kind of qualifications for being able to debate in September become stricter. So they kind of need to be polling at least 2% or have a certain amount of support in terms of donations. And so it's really key that they have to prove themselves to try to kind of get beyond those at least low single digit numbers.
Pete, as you look at this, if you were Bernie Sanders' campaign, would you be concerned about the erosion in this poll from April to July?
Well, I think, yeah, I think trajectory is something that you always look at. And as you say, over this last month or so has been difficult. I still think, as to what Professor Merola rightly points out, it's about getting into the fall and then getting into that first primary The numbers seem to show that block at the top. It's between Biden and Sanders and Harris and Warren. I really think that the winner of the primary overall is going to come out of one of those four candidates. I at this point find it extremely difficult to believe that one of the other lower tier candidates can make it. But I really think that the race is going to be on really in the fall, and it's about getting to the fall and getting stage by stage by stage. The primary process iterates. So even looking at the state primary polling now, I think really belies the fact that what happens in Iowa will determine what happens in New Hampshire, Nevada, or South Carolina and going forward.
I was looking at Monmouth University's poll that came out late last week, looking at South Carolina, because Kamala Harris is putting a lot of her eggs in the South Carolina basket because the large number of African-American voters and her team's belief that she can really break through there. But Jennifer, Joe Biden continues to be very strong with the African-American electorate in South Carolina.
Yes, and that's, you know, somewhat to be expected, right? He has a great deal of name recognition. He was in the Obama administration, which is extremely popular with African-American voters. And African-Americans really want someone that is going to beat Donald Trump. At the same time, we saw some of this happen in 2008, where Clinton started, right, the primary season with a great deal of African-American support. But when it was clear that Barack Obama was a viable candidate, right, that support really shifted dramatically, right? So the same thing could happen over time, and we just have to see kind of how things play out. Kamala Harris is trying to make bigger appeals to the black community with policies that speak directly to the community, and so that may gain some traction. We'll also see in the debate, my guess is they're going to continue kind of some of the issues on race that were brought up in the first debate, where, you know, Biden had pretty poor performance in responding to those. And so I'll be very curious to see if he tries to defend, right, his kind of prior stances on issues and kind of double down, or if he'll show some evolution on issues of race, which he may have to do to kind of maintain that African-American support.
Kamala Harris, speaking of policy, has come out with more details about her health care plan, which would not be a full single payer, but would be access to Medicare, while private insurance would continue to be an option. She says that that could be paid for with just taxing higher earners, people who make over $100,000 a year, as well as on stock market transactions and the like. She says that the middle class wouldn't have to bear the financial brunt of that. This in stark contrast to Joe Biden, of course, who has strongly supported the Affordable Care Act and says Obamacare just needs to be strengthened. That's the best option. Jennifer, how do you see those competing plans playing with the base?
Well, I mean, this, you know, it will be interesting. I'm very curious to see how much the base is really paying attention to all of these details. I mean, these are pretty complex arguments. It makes sense that Biden would be running on the ACA, right? This helps connect him to the popular Obama administration and to defend a record achievement of that administration. Kamala Harris, it's interesting because she is trying to kind of position herself between Biden as well as Warren and Sanders, right? Because as we've already talked about, like, those three are polling very close to each other, so they want to stand out. And so it's an interesting attempt, right, to try to kind of capture those voters who see maybe some issues with the ACA, but may be happy with their private insurance and don't really want to give it up. And so I'll be really interested to see how much the public is paying attention to those distinctions and whether it really helps kind of Kamala to gain more support among those who really care about this issue and aren't really happy with the ACA or kind of Medicare for All, as kind of Sanders and Warren are promoting.
Pete, it's interesting because, you know, Jennifer talking about the effort to differentiate herself and kind of setting up in the middle of those four candidates. Biden is undoubtedly going to go after her on the cost of this and argue that you can't finance it other than to tax the middle class, and pretty significantly. Is that argument, do you think, going to carry much weight with voters?
I think actually there's a bigger dynamic at work here, and that is what is the future of the Obama coalition and Obama voters? I agree with Professor Merola that in many ways we're asking Democrats to get into the weeds on some of these various proposals. But in many ways, Biden is really trying to tie himself to his time with President Obama, both in as a personal relationship, but also a policy relationship. At the same time, there's a large group, or at least a vocal group of Democrats that see the loss of Secretary Clinton in 2016 as really the ending of the Obama coalition, or at least the Obama set of policies, that they did not go, frankly, progressive enough. There have been a number of Democrat progressive activists speaking on various television shows, Sunday shows yesterday, saying that really the Democrats under Obama didn't go far enough with Obamacare, that there really should have been a proposal for single payer, and that opens the door for people like Sanders, who I think really in this race now is about thinking who out of the Sanders, Warren, Harris group is going to really step forward here to challenge Biden. But I think right now it's the connection to Obama, not so much about the specifics on Obamacare, but the connection to Obama in a broader policy and personal perspective that voters are going to have to wrestle with.
We'll continue our conversation with Dean Pete Peterson, Pepperdine University Professor Jennifer Merola of UC Riverside. We'll be back 1 minute from now on Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Did you, after your parents' death, have to go through their things? And did you make some surprising discoveries in their possessions that they left behind? Or maybe you learned something about your mother or father that you had no idea was a part of their life. We're going to open up the phones for you to share that with us coming up next hour on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. President Trump just tweeted about 20 minutes ago that he's looking forward to meeting at 11 o'clock Pacific time with what he says are wonderful inner city pastors. This comes in the wake of the president's blistering comments about Baltimore. And Elijah Cummings, a Congress member who represents that area, the president has kept up a string of tweets about Baltimore and essentially what a hellhole it is, according to the president, and about what he has described as the terrible leadership of Congressman Cummings. Jennifer Merola, UC Riverside Professor of Political Science. Your thoughts about how the president characterized both the city of Baltimore and the leadership of the congressman?
Yeah, so this is this type of very explicit racial rhetoric is what we've come to expect from the president. But it doesn't mean that it shouldn't be strongly condemned as unacceptable and contrary to American principles of racial equality each time. In this particular case, we did see elites from both parties condemn the tweet, which, you know, we've done some research at the University of California, Riverside, to show that it is really important to have elites from both sides of the political spectrum condemn this type of rhetoric. And this was particularly pernicious in the sense that some of the language used in the tweets was dehumanizing language, right? He was talking about being, you know, disgusting rat and rodent-infested city. And that can be really harmful to intergroup relations, especially when you get to that type of rhetoric. And as a sidebar, it's also, of course, a gross mischaracterization of the district and, the Congress members' leadership, right? The district is a bit above the median for household income and is a bit above the average percentage of people living in poverty. It also has a really high percentage of college graduates in the district. And so, you know, not only is it problematic in terms of racial rhetoric, but it also is just a mischaracterization.
The president a couple days ago tweeted that Cummings District is a disgusting rat and rodent infested mess. If he spent more time in Baltimore, maybe he could help clean up this very dangerous and filthy place. Now, the president since then has tweeted about Bernie Sanders' negative comments about poverty in Baltimore and characterizations of the city. Pete Peterson, do you think that that's a fair comparison?
No, I don't. But I would say what he's also done is tweet about Nancy Pelosi's district. And I just think that this is a president who reacts viscerally and personally to any perceived attacks. I think it's absolutely right to condemn these kinds of tweets. I don't see them as racist, though. But at the same time, I do see them as unfitting for a president to speak in a way that's so personal and to speak of particular areas of the United States and to lay the blame or shame or attacks, if you will, on a particular congressman or woman for what's happening within that particular district. As Professor Merola says, there are other things that are rather positive about that particular district, but you're not going to hear that from this president.
I mean, the fact that it is a majority African-American district, Pete, you don't think that sort of characterizing it as a filthy, rodent-infested place, that carries a racial connotation to it, even though he's not explicitly talking about race in the tweet?
I really don't, Larry. I don't see that. I mean, he's made comments about other people's districts and what's going on in their districts. He did the same thing with not the same thing, but at least a somewhat similar attack on a district of a political leader with Nancy Pelosi. And so I just don't see it that way. What I do see it is unfitting for a president to attack any area of the United States in that particular way and to lay the blame at a congressman or woman for what's happening there.
Esther Goth writes on the page, Baltimore is a filthy rat infested mess. Trump supporters know this, and this entire issue is helping him get reelected. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. The president also tweeting, Pete, that he's considering declaring Antifa a terrorist organization. Now, can the president unilaterally make such a declaration?
My understanding is that he can't. I do know that Senators Cassidy from Louisiana and Cruz from Texas have put forward a non-binding resolution that would essentially designate Antifa as a terrorist organization. This would have to have a lot more eyes and ears on it, and certainly the engagement of the intelligence community. That designation would open up greater powers for the FBI and related intelligence agencies to investigate Antifa. But again, it's a very hard thing to designate. Antifa has shown itself to be pretty loosely organized, but at the same time, there are steps that have been taken by individual Antifa chapters, which are terrorist in nature. If you see what's happened up in Portland, what happened in Berkeley, I don't see how you could look at these actions as anything other than terrorist in nature.
I think the question would be, setting that issue aside, whether objectively there is a terroristic element in Antifa, can a president just unilaterally do that? Because, Professor Merola, you could have a president go after any political entity.
Yeah, it is a dangerous precedent. So it's not surprising that President Trump would do this. It's, you know, not out of character, but it does seem like it would, you know, he would at the end of the day have to work with intelligence communities, work with members of Congress, and it's more likely to have credibility in that type of
situation. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. We're too quickly out of time because of our special coverage of the Gilroy News Conference. My thanks to Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine School of Public Policy, and Professor Jennifer Merola, UC Riverside. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'll tell you what's to come in hour two momentarily. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up next, we'll focus on if you had a father or mother who passed away, you went through their things. Maybe you got a big surprise, something you didn't know about your parents, something maybe was a little disturbing for you or particularly exciting about their background. You had no knowledge of it. They hadn't spoken to you about it. Maybe you're even estranged from one or both of your parents, but you had to go in and handle the aftermath of their passing and go through their things, and you had a range of strong emotions. We're going to open up the phones, hear from you about that coming up later this hour. But first, San Luis Obispo, a city along the central California coast, home of Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, has passed tentatively a change in its policy on public art. It would ban public art projects that memorialize someone who had lived or someone who was currently living. In other words, no more statues unless it's a mythical figure or someone like the Statue of Liberty that embodies a concept. With us to talk about why San Luis Obispo is taking this step is Tyler Pratt, reporter with Central Coast Public Radio's KCBX. Tyler, good to have you with us. Tyler, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Tyler, what's the background? Was there a particular statue that brought this into controversy?
So in January of this year, a local group was working on plans to install a privately funded statue of President Theodore Roosevelt in a public space. And of course, that has to go before city council. And it drew the ire of our mayor and a lot of people wondering, first of all, why put a statue of Theodore Roosevelt instead of someone more closely connected with the town? And then it also spawned a conversation about who and what we should be putting up monuments and statues to in this city.
And so they have initially passed this rule that there'll be no statues, and then that comes back for a second reading?
Yeah, so what they did is they had a discussion in July about the city's basically asked staff for a 5-month study on monuments policies and different cities that have them. And staff came back and showed different monuments policies in cities across California and the state and the nation, as well as cities that don't have them. And the consensus was is there is no golden rule for what to do. And so the council, pretty unanimously led by the mayor at the forefront of this, said, you know what, we're not going to have any monuments to people, and directed staff to update the public arts policy, saying instead of not having a monuments policy, the policy is no monuments to people, and that will come back and likely be approved at a future date.
Now, on our AirTalk segment page, we've got what I think is a terrific statue of Albert Einstein. His arms outstretched, he's leaning back, it looks like he's enjoying the sunshine, at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. It's a beautiful sculpture, in my view. So that kind of thing, that could still be done by the university, correct? This would just be for public places that the city controls?
This goes for, yes, public spots. So this was planned to go in a public park, even though, again, like I said, it was privately funded in a public space.
All right. I would love to hear from AirTalk listeners. What do you think about this? Do you think that we're past the era where we have statues of people, either living or dead? Should we no longer do that because there could be or are negative things about that individual? Therefore, we shouldn't have the image of the person there on public display. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me is frequent AirTalk guest Bill Deverell, professor of history and director of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West at USC. Bill, good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Larry. Always a pleasure.
What is the historic idea behind statues been? What's their express purpose?
Well, it's very complicated, and this notion of no monuments policies or no golden rule makes a lot of sense to me. It would be very hard to find kind of hard and fast rules about who gets memorialized or commemorated or what ideas. Oftentimes, you find monuments going up after periods of great stress, wars or other things, and the victors get the choice to kind of memorialize those who they've chosen to put down through history in bronze or granite or other kinds of statuary. So there's always political stakes at in monuments, not just simply monuments, but the ways in which you name your communities, the ways you name your streets. They all are tied to historical moments. And oftentimes the monuments don't go up for decades and decades after that event, which is supposedly being memorialized.
So here in the case of the Einstein-Cal Poly, we're seeing memorialized someone who's made extraordinary contributions to physics. There are those who would talk about his first marriage and how he behaved in that and what. And almost any individual you can think of who would have a statue would have aspects of their life that could cause some people to think, I can't approve of that because I don't like how that individual lived this portion of his or her life. How do we talk about this in a way that makes sense?
Well, it can get very hot and vociferous, and we see that all across America now with real fundamental questions about who we are as a people and who we choose to lift up and pedestal, literally. You're right that anyone can be scrutinized, and there are reasons to look askance at some of their behaviors or ideas. But these debates are kind of a fundamental practice of democracy. So talking about who we are and what ideas motivate us to think in the long term, that's really enshrined, or I think should be, in the ways in which a democracy maintains its health.
I would, again, love to hear from listeners. What do you think about this? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jack in Zurich writes on the page, SLO for San Luis Obispo. This is why we can't have nice things. 866-893-KPECC. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley says, I'm waiting for the Harry Potter statue. Yes, you could have literary figures, mythical figures, a Statue of Liberty, but in San Luis Obispo, it appears likely you will not be able to have an actual living or deceased person. 866-893-KPECC. David in Santa Monica, what do you think?
Well, I think it's pretty sad what's happening. It's, in order to prevent offending any group of people, not to have art. In its own way, all art is going to be offensive in either a good or a bad way that makes people think. And when you take statues, for example, you have it representing a certain person. Most people would imagine that it's for a good thing, but no one is perfect. And if we look at our culture today, whether the statues from the 1700s, 1800s, or 1900s, people are outraged over what these statues represent for these individuals, even though at the times they were perfect for that situation. But people's idea of perfection changes over time, and the fact that now we can't celebrate these individuals is really sad.
David, appreciate your call. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Bill, as a historian, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Just my sort of sense is that in the past, people didn't consider the private life aspect of a so-called great person, I'll put that in quotation marks, as being necessarily relevant. Short of murder or, something that sort of wasn't really part of how we think of the person in terms of societal contribution. Do you think that's right or not? And if so, has that changed?
I think it is right. I think it has changed. I think the divide between one's personal and public personas and personal public identities have changed radically in the sort of culture of celebrity and 24/7 news cycles and internet access to information right or wrong. So I think that's been coming for decades and decades, but I do think it's profoundly changed since some arbitrary past.
Tyler Pratt of KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I don't know whether you were at the council meeting where this was discussed, but you have a sense of public sentiment that was presented at that meeting?
The public sentiment that was initially expressed following the mayor's Facebook post and on comments was a lot of people, as the mayor brought up, "No, why are we making more statues to white men?" So the public comment became, well, why not have a statue to somebody more affiliated with the city, or perhaps a statue to a woman or a person of color that contributed to the San Luis Obispo community. This is where we moved into monuments policy and things got iffy.
two, the gentleman who wanted to make the statue still believes very strongly that statue should go up. Someone on a cultural heritage committee says by saying no monuments to people, it creates a slippery slope for how public art will be figured out moving forward. One council member did make the point, that someone could be fabulous then and not be fabulous later, that being her version, but also that cities are tasked with taking care of these art projects and these statues, which can sometimes be expensive. You put a monument up and it gets defaced and it gets defaced again and they eventually have to take it down.
Yeah. We're talking with Tyler Pratt, KCBX Public Radio. Bill, that sounds like just the kind of debate you want to have. Should Teddy Roosevelt, the president who we think of as the father of the national parks and anti-monopolist and obviously some controversies too, but, made huge contributions to the country that we know today, or should it be a local person? Should it be someone more representative of the diversity community? That seems all like a positive conversation.
It's absolutely a positive conversation. It's not necessarily without hurt and heartache, but I think one of the other things we ought to acknowledge here is that universalizing these decisions is probably a big mistake. In other words, San Luis Obispo has its own history and culture. People there know it far better than, say, myself sitting in a studio in Pasadena. So the local conversation about what matters to the local population is critical, and hearing from all sides or as many sides as possible. I take Tyler's point very well that, it seems a little curious to me that Teddy Roosevelt would find his way into statuary in San Luis Obispo. I'm sure there are others in that community's history and perhaps even in its present that deserve a hearing. But it seems to me that the ideas about what is it we're trying to memorialize, what is it we're trying to celebrate through time, what is it we're trying to put into bronze or other form that will outlast us, that's the really important first step.
Let me take another comment off our AirTalk page. JJ writes, I recently went on a literary and architecture tour of Wilshire Boulevard. The bust of G. Allen Hancock sits near the La Brea Tar Pits. He donated that land to the county. His philanthropy is immortalized in the bust. What's wrong with such a memorial? That's JJ writing on the page. Now, I mean, that is a specific site link, though, Bill.
Yeah, absolutely. And it memorializes a philanthropic gift in that way. So it is, but it would be perfectly appropriate, I think, for people to ask questions about who was this guy and why is his bust here, and have further discussions about the power and meaning of history in our lives in the current day.
Let's take another call. This is from Joe in Topanga. Joe, good to have you with us. What do you think about a ban on statues?
Well, actually, I wanted to say, I think the discussion's fantastic about all the angles that this really goes from. I wanted to respond specifically to the caller in Santa Monica, because I felt he was a bit all over the place. And while he was on target about saying perceptions change, which I think we can't be afraid of, that what was appropriate for our nation at one point isn't appropriate now, I strongly disagree that this, with the premise at all, that this is an attack on art. It seems to me that if you're making a demand that a monument somehow expresses the ideas, the sentiments, the values that go into the monument, rather than just putting an individual's face, that's an encouragement of an artistic expression, not an attack on it being an artistic expression at all.
All right, Joe, I appreciate it very much. 866-893-KPCC. Bazzer writes on the page, I grew up in SLO, went away to college in 81, have only occasionally returned to visit my folks. I hardly recognize my hometown. What happened to the live and let live attitude that made it so unique? Kind of disturbing. Let's see. We also have Norma in Lakewood. I don't know that this needs to be legislated, but it's, be honest, it's rare that we even know who the statues are of. And Bill in the San Gabriel Valley says, we know humans are flawed and not perfect. If you investigate any historical figure, you'll find something about them that someone will dislike. Should those negative things take away from the positive accomplishments the historical figure is known for? We'll continue our conversation about the policy being adopted by San Luis Obispo against in any city places future statues, either of living individuals or those who've died. It's Air Talk on KPCC. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with reporter with Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Tyler Pratt, who sharing with us the San Luis Obispo City Council, their initial vote, pending a final vote, to no longer have in public places statues of individuals, that public art instead would commemorate certain ideas, certain events. It could be a depiction of an individual who isn't a living or previously living person, but like the Statue of Liberty embodies an ideal. What do you think of that? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Eve in Venice, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm a former public art administrator, and I find what the mayor in San Luis Obispo is doing is very, very short-sighted. The whole notion of commissioning public art, even if it's private money on public land, is that there should be a community process. There should be people talking about what they want to do and why they want to do it and have an opportunity for the community to respond. And so I think he's just really missing the mark, and these things should be done on a case-by-case basis. And it really, it also should be a bigger decision than just the mayor, because it really affects the whole city and sets a really bad precedent.
Eve, I appreciate it. And we know, you certainly know as a former public arts administrator, that these can become very contentious. And is this something you think other cities might consider because it takes them out of the line of fire and criticism for this?
Sure. I think, and again, it's dangerous, you know, because again, it's the public. You're supposed to be able to talk about these things. I mean, they impact community. It shouldn't be an edict, you know, from a mayor. So I would worry that it is a dangerous precedent because there are so many communities that have had to deal with some contemporary sculptures, but, you know, certainly historic sculptures. But again, it's dialogue. And even if something changes and these things are no longer maybe relevant to a community, you know, people need to talk about it.
Eve, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Eve in Venice. Let me go back to Tyler Pratt of KCBX. Do you know if there are other cities that have developed a policy like San Luis Obispo's?
So the city of Auburn has a monuments policy that's the framework is a public art policy. The city of San Jose has a specific monument policy. Davis, Santa Barbara, and Santa Cruz, they have memorial policies under review right now. But other cities across California, say like Ventura, Santa Monica, Monterey, they don't have one.
So all right.
It's a mix right now.
Okay. Valerie in Sherman Oaks, you're on Air Talk.
I think, you know, that these depictions of people's shells, that's not even art necessarily. I think that that it's we want to remember their ideas and their contributions to society, not what they look like and maybe, you know, that goes into that, you know, their personal life. And you know, and I don't even think it's art necessarily, like, to do a realistic depiction of someone. That's yards.
Hmm. Well, Valerie, I think a lot of artists might dispute that issue, because if you look at the Einstein statue at Cal Poly Pomona, to me, that's art. It's beautiful. It's not a photorealistic depiction of him. It's an artistic representation, including his facial expression, the way he's relating to the space and that he's in. So that to me is a tough argument to make. It's not art. But then the question is, Bill Devereaux, can you effectively memorialize someone's ideas without their personality, their physicality being connected to it? Because one of the things we hear is young people need role models. They need to have people that look like themselves or that they can see themselves. If it's just concepts, how do you do that?
I think it can be done. I think it's harder, but I think it can be done with ancillary installations, so text or perhaps photographic imagery of the person that may be embedded in text and all. But, you know, in one sense, far be it from me or other historians to tell San Luis Obispo what to do. But I think it seems smart to me to have a discussion about why do we have monuments? What are the ideas that we're looking to memorialize? So what are those abstract things that we want to celebrate through time? And then how do we find our way to cast those ideas into some artistic form that can but might not include the human form? I wouldn't make this blanket rule.
Bill Deverell, historian with us from USC and the Huntington Library. He directs the Huntington SC Institute on California and the West, also professor of history, University of Southern California. In case you just tuned in, we're talking about the city of San Luis Obispo on the Central Coast adopting a policy that for public art would no longer allow for statues of individuals deceased or living. And we're asking whether you think that's a good policy or not. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. RTB writes, it would seem to me statues in a community should be of someone who has a more specific meaning to that particular community. I would guess a lot of people in San Luis Obispo might think Teddy Roosevelt was a known historical figure, but why the statue here? But Bill, I could definitely see why, if you wanted to have someone who was involved in early San Luis Obispo, let's say founded the first public school or something like that, and you wanted to put a statue of that individual at the school district headquarters or something. I'm just pulling this out of thin air, but that there might be value to sort of remember, oh, yeah, there's an origin story here.
Oh, absolutely. Communities knowing themselves by way of what still exists or what's been memorialized towards the past, that's a hugely important lesson. And then connecting that person to maybe universal ideas about, let's say, public education or diversity of educational admittance, that kind of thing. So you bet. I think you can build up from the highly local into the universal.
Want to thank you for being with us, Bill Deverell, joining us on Air Talk. My thanks to Tyler Pratt, KCBX, NPR member station, Central Coast Public Radio. Tyler, reporter there, joining us to talk about San Luis Obispo's action. We'll continue by talking about what surprising discoveries you might have made when you went through your parents' personal effects after their passing, something which made you feel you knew them much better. Maybe positively, maybe not. Our phone lines are open at 866-893-KPECC. Back in 1 minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up at noon, less than half an hour away. This sounds like a fascinating interview. Terry's going to talk with the author of Buzz, Sting, Bite, Why Fruit Flies Are More Useful Than We Think, How Cockroaches Could Be Vital for Our Survival. I got to hear that. The Bizarre World of Insects, Why We Can't Live Without Them. That's Terry Gross with the author of Buzz, Sting, Bite, coming up at noon here on KPECC. But for this next portion of the program, I want to hear from you your experiences going through the personal effects of your parents, your father or mother, after they passed. Maybe you were the one with siblings or on your own who had to go through what they left behind, clean out their house or apartment, deal with all the after effects. And if that brought you a tremendous surprise, either emotionally or in what it revealed about your parents' life that you didn't know, I'd like to hear from you at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Having written about this topic, Los Angeles Times lifestyle and culture writer Aline Dawson. Aline, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry. Grateful to be here.
Do you have personal experience with this?
I do. My dad passed during the holidays in 2013, and my dad loved the outdoors and dreamed of going to Alaska, and hip surgery prevented that. I was surprised in going through his things that what I wanted most were his sturdy hiking pack, big fuzzy pullover three times bigger than me, and his survivalist handbook. Belongings don't have to represent a shared history. They can connect to a concept a parent had, and I can continue his legacy. He thought about exploring, and those items resonated with me, and now I'm planning a trip to Alaska.
That's great, and you've got his things to remember.
I do.
That's wonderful, and a great way to celebrate also what your father meant to you.
That's right.
Was there anything that was surprising, either books he had or any of his effects, that it's like, well, I didn't know that about my dad?
Well, I knew that he was he loved the great outdoors, but when I saw those handbooks, his survivalist handbook and that kind of thing, he was really prepared for it.
So he was going to extreme. He was.
That's right.
So, if the apocalypse happened, he was going to be prepared.
He was prepared, a la Y2K, yes.
And looking out for you, too, I'm sure, in there.
Very much.
866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Judy Ann Alhambra said, when my father died, my mother didn't know anything about his belongings. He had a locked cabinet. We pried it open and found $10,000. Wow. That's Judy in Alhambra, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Daniel in Van Nuys, what did you come across that was a surprise?
Hi. When I was cleaning out my mother's apartment, I found a box of papers of my father's, and there were all these letters from organizations and people thanking him for participating in projects, taking a lead on projects, community projects and things. And it turned out that my father was a great guy, and I didn't know it. I was 18 when he passed away, so I don't really get a chance to know him. And I thought, wow, this is a guy I should have known better. And at least I found that out.
Yeah, and these are things that when you were growing up, your dad hadn't mentioned to you any of these activities.
No, not at all.
Wow. Daniel, thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Carrie, in Simi Valley, what was the surprise for you after your parents' passing?
My father passed at age 95. He and my mom were married for 67 years. My mom and I decided 2 months later to go to Valentine's Day dinner together. Mom said, let's go to one of Dad's favorite delis. He went with his buddies. So we went to the deli, and before we were seated, the cash register gal said, well, do you have any cards that might have points? And we said, no, we don't have any points card. And anybody you know that might have been here? Well, my father came here often with his buddies. Well, what was his number, his phone number and name? She searched for him, found him, and he, by golly, had eaten so much there that he had $75 in points. So here it was, our first Valentine's Day without him, and Dad was still buying us our dinner.
I love that, posthumously treating you to dinner. Care that, and was this very fitting for your father?
Oh, it really was. Absolutely super generous man. Would not never let anyone else pay for anything. And here we go. He's still buying us dinner.
That's great. Carrie, thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We're going to talk with Marina in Encino. We're also going to continue with Los Angeles Times lifestyle and culture writer Aline Dawson, who's written about this topic, has her own personal experience she's sharing as well. After you lost your mother or your father or both, you went through their effects. Were there any shocks for you, any warm surprises, or ones that have been difficult for you to process? I'm sure that's an experience that many of our listeners have had, too. 866-893-KPECC. Back right after a live update from Hetty. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Again, if you joined us Saturday night, Theater at Ace Hotel downtown for our Film Week screening, thank you. I hope you had as much fun as I did. We showed Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights, had a great post-film conversation with the producer of the film, the costume designer, all those wild 70s and early 80s costumes, our film critic Tim Cogshell, and Shira Tarrant, Cal State Long Beach professor, all joining us. Really fun night. I hope you join us for our next one coming up November 2nd. We will hopefully very soon announce which movie we're going to be showing. They're all films set in L.A., so that gives you a little bit of a head start. I hope you can join us next time. Right now on Air Talk, we're looking at parents passing away and going in and cleaning out their living spaces, going through their personal effects. Was there something you came across that was shocking that changed the way you thought of your parents, negatively or positively, or that in some way changed the way you felt you related to them afterwards? 866-893-KPECC. Sally in Encino, welcome.
Hi. I discovered that my dad, who I knew as an aerospace engineer who helped design the first space shuttle, when he was 19, was in the Civilian Conservation Corps. There was a photograph of him with his registration papers sitting on a horse, picking up litter in the middle of I don't know where, but it was like this whole side of my adolescent dad that I'd never known about.
Why do you think he didn't share that? Because that's notable that he was with the CCC.
Yeah, I just, you know, I think there are a lot of things you end up not talking about with your parents because they don't consider it. I mean, he talked to me about his college years. He talked to me about getting arrested for frolicking in a fountain when he was drunk at Carnegie Mellon. But he never told me about the CCC.
All right, Sally. Thanks. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Diana in Sherman Oaks said, my aunt died and got confused till the end. She had shoe boxes of letters, and I was wondering if I should go through them, just so many of them. But I'm glad I did. I found a $10,000 bond. That's Diana in Sherman Oaks. Los Angeles Times lifestyle culture writer Aline Dawson. Do you have any advice for people about, you know, how detailed to be in going through this, that whether it's letters or other personal effects?
Sure. Studies show that we get the same emotional feeling from a photograph as we do from an actual object very often. So you don't need to hold on to that object to preserve it for a legacy. You can get an emotional legacy from taking photographs of it. Now our phones take thousands of photos, right? So
you don't need to have the actual thing taking up space, move it from place to place.
That's right, especially if it's a short turnaround, if you've only got a day or two to clean out the parents' apartment or home.
My grandparents during World War II wrote letters on a daily basis to each other and saved all of the letters. And then years later, after my grandparents passed, my aunt went through and read almost all of those letters. And it was great because she was able, as, you know, being retired, to sort of find the nuggets, the really special ones that the rest of us in the family would be interested in. So if there's someone, you know, in a larger family who has the time and interest in doing it, it's a wonderful service for other members of the family. Let's talk with Marina in Encino. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. Listen, my story is a little bit different. My sisters and I were taking care of my aunt's effects. She'd never married, and we had a lot of stuff, but she was a great list writer, and we kept reading these lists of things, and one of them was the events in her life, and in it was like first baby, and a little while later, second baby, and we're looking at each other like, what? And so we found some cousins that we are now great friends with, and they got to meet each other, and it's been wonderful. It's like having my aunt back.
That's great. You wish you'd known earlier, I bet.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But she didn't want to tell anybody, so we never did. We couldn't share that.
Krista tweets at AirTalk, my father passed away when I was 19 back in 1998. And when my mother passed last year, I discovered she'd kept the contents of my father's office in a box, relatively untouched. Finding it was like finding a time capsule of loss. Going through it has been bittersweet. Krista, I'll bet.
because it brings that person just right up front again. And Aline, it reminds you of what you've lost.
It does. Parents belonging are emerging of our history and their history. Not only does it represent a story about their lives, but it's asking about our lives with them. The items are about connection.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jack writes on the page, when I was in college, my girlfriend at the time left for the weekend to help her parents clean out her grandparents' house after they passed away. She came back Monday looking horrified. Tough dealing with the memories, I said. No, not the memories. That's all good. Took about a week before she told me that they were cleaning out a closet. She found a suitcase filled with every kind of sex toy imaginable in her grandparents' closet. That's Jack, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Judy in Irvine, you're on AirTalk.
Hi, mine's a negative story. My mother died at age 94 in 2011, and she had apparently kept journals while she was in therapy when she was in her 80s, and she left those journals for me to find, and they're very negative. She was very unhappy. She was very unhappy with my father, and the journals are just totally full of how totally miserable she was and how much she hated my father. And I knew she was unhappy, but the extreme of it is very shocking.
At some point when you started reading, did you think about putting it down or not continuing? Or you felt like there was such a drive to better know your mom, you had to continue?
I have very mixed feelings about it, and I've had them all along. I feel she left them for me intentionally because she did clean out the house at one point, so surely she kept them for me to find. So
if you had known, back closer to the time that she was writing that, how strong her feelings were, do you think you would have addressed this with your mother directly?
She talked to me about it some, but I don't know. I don't know what I would have told her. I mean, she was seeing a therapist, but apparently it wasn't helping.
Yeah, and it's got to be so sad to see how unhappy she was. Judy, thank you for sharing that. Judy in Irvine, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tina in Long Beach said, I didn't know my father was Cuban until he died. And after I found that out, I took a journey to Cuba to learn more about him and our culture. Tina, that's a pretty big thing for you not to know that your father had immigrated from Cuba. 866-893-KPECC. What did you find in your parents' effects that shocked you, that opened up an aspect of your family or your parents' relationship you just had known nothing about? Maybe it created some problems like Judy was describing, or maybe something beautiful that you discovered you never anticipated. 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute. Given we're in Southern California, I half expected we'd get some calls from listeners who discovered their parents had been, like a government spy or something, because all the intelligence work here in Southern California and aerospace and everything, living a secret double life. We haven't had that yet, but we're still open at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're talking about shocks that can come from going through a deceased parent's personal effects. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're talking with Aline Dawson, LA Times lifestyle and culture writer. A couple calls ago, we had listeners
listener, you know, just talking about how the whole intermingling of the grief process when going through affects.
Yes, it has a big impact. And a big thank you to David Kessler from grief.com. He was one of the experts that I interviewed for this most recent story I worked on. And not to put upon yourself great pressure or expectations to have a certain kind of feeling. For some people, it's a relief. When a parent died, they may not have been nice to you or a nice person. So to allow yourself a variety of potential feelings about it, and grief.com is a terrific resource.
That's good to know. Yeah, and sometimes a child's been in a caregiver position for many years and seen up close the pain that the parent's been in, and the passing is a blessing, as difficult as it is to lose the loved one.
And if you're an only child, bring a friend to go through their belongings is what's suggested. You don't have to do that all alone.
Okay. As an only child, I'm glad to hear that. My father said to me that whenever he passes, just bring the dumpster up to his house and just say, you don't have to go through anything. There's nothing of value. Just toss it straight away. Hopefully that won't happen for a long, long time. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jane in Sherman Oaks says, my great-great-grandfather was a senator from Minnesota, and in his old desk, which I went through after my parents died, I found letters written in old-fashioned script with a fine quill pen. I'm now trying to decipher what's in that handwriting. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Carol in Santa Monica, what did you find?
That's me, right?
Yeah, you're Carol in Santa Monica. It's you.
Thank you. Yes, I had a set of parents who were at the University of Wisconsin. They were the bogey and baby of the campus. Mother was 15 when they met, and Dad was 25 and a professor. And she chased him around for about 4 years, and he finally said, Marilyn, it's getting too expensive to date you. Let's just get married.
And you found all these letters that documented this.
Yes, I did. That's what I was about to say.
Yeah.
Letters that where he was very tender and young somehow and missing her.
Yeah.
Really, really gave me a turn.
Thanks, Carol. Appreciate it. Let's talk with Lori in Leimert Park. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. Yes. My parents recently died in the last 3 years, and I found both funny things and sad things. One thing that was funny is we found thousands of dollars in $10 and $20 increments stuffed into all my mother's books. So we had to shake out every book and magazine to get every last bill.
Wow.
Yeah, nobody knew she was stashing money away. And then the sad thing is I found years of correspondence she had with my sister that was all about horrible, terrible things about me. And I had no idea that this correspondence was going back and forth between them for years. So that was kind of sad, and I'm left with that.
So that's got to be difficult. Now, is your sister still alive?
Oh, yes, she is. Yes.
Have you brought this up with her?
I haven't brought it up with her because before I even found the letters at my mother's funeral, she blew up at me, and my other siblings and I were shocked and had no idea why. But now I kind of feel like there must have been decades of anger brewing that I didn't know about.
Lori, thank you for sharing that. I assume you wish that she would have said these things to you so you knew back
Absolutely.
At the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Lori, thanks. Well, at least a lot of money coming out of that. Aline, the money's got to be a great thing. But then if you find, you know, one thing that's hidden away, that sort of, as she was saying, opens up the door. You got to look everywhere then for money that's stowed.
Yes. It's interesting. When I talked to David Kessler, he said, especially if there are multiple siblings, that a parent should talk to their kids about what's there in possessions and what could be hidden away before they go. It's hard to split if you've got one thing three different ways, four different ways. And sometimes it's better not to be surprised.
We have Robin from Redland. She said, when my father died, and that was 8 years after my mother passed away, I found among my father's things a bottle of Viagra with a recent prescription. I was shocked. So she had no idea that her dad was enjoying a full social life. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's see. Brianna said, I had hoped that I would find something very private or interesting. I was hoping to unearth a secret life of sorts for some strange reason, but to my disappointment, that wasn't the case at all. My mother kept very little information, none of which was revelatory. And that's interesting with Brianna, because that's sort of the flip side, that maybe you hope you're going to get to know a parent that you felt some distance from, and there's nothing there.
Yes. When a parent dies, we are forced into decreasing the evidence that they lived here on Earth, right? Selling car clothes, selling a house. Our internal task is to increase the evidence that they lived inside of us. So even if we don't have things that were left behind, we can carry their legacy forward.
Alfredo in Oxnard, good to have you with us. What did you find in your parents' effects?
Yeah, so what happened was, unfortunately, when my dad passed away, some other family members had asked me to get into his wallet and see, you know, what was in it. And when I opened it up, I saw that my dad had kept a $5 bill that I had given to him back like 25 years ago when I was like 8 years old. For his birthday. And I know it was mine, or, you know, I know it was the same one because I had written all over it saying, you know, happy birthday, Dad. You're the best dad ever.
And he kept it. Was it in his wallet?
Yeah. So, yeah, he had it in his wallet folded up. And then, you know, and obviously he changed his wallet several times throughout those 25 years. And, you know, I lost it. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I was going to say, how'd you respond when you opened the wallet?
Oh, yeah. When I opened it and I saw it, I'm even trying to stop, you know, like choking up right now. But
yeah. Yeah. It makes me emotional. I don't know you or your dad, but Alfredo, thanks. That's a wonderful story. Just wonderful about how much obviously that meant to him and how much you meant to your father. Thank you so much. Veronica in Madera said, when my mother died, I found diaries she kept from a trip we took to Europe. She wrote that she was miserable the whole time we were on the trip. It was a huge disappointment to me because she didn't act like she was having a bad time. I still have those diaries. That's Veronica in Madera. Ali, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it. And talking about the piece you wrote on this subject.
Thank you. Grateful to be here.
Thank you. That's Aline Dawson, lifestyle and culture writer for the Los Angeles Times. You can share your stories of going through your late parents' effects on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back with you tomorrow.